Apparently, I didn't know this, but apparently I'm of Scottish descent. I tell you, I wish I knew this back in the day when, Braveheart was popular. Everybody wanted to be Scottish back then for about a year, right? But not so much these days. Watson has always sounded English to me, but my family were very disconnected from our extended family. We don't know anything about our lineage. And a few years ago, one of my brothers started researching, where did we Watsons come from? And we were surprised to learn that we were thoroughly, thoroughly Scottish. But what my brother learned about our family was not that impressive. You see, the Watson family in Scotland never reached clan status. We Watsons fell under the ranking of sept. It's a lower class of Scottish clan. It means we followed somebody else's chief. And we were mainly associated with Clan Buchanan, which, unfortunately, history tells us that Clan Buchanan is reputed to have betrayed Sir William Wallace to King Edward I of England on August 5th, 1305. I come by my devious ways honestly, okay? There's a lesson there, isn't there? Yes. It's probably for the best that I didn't know back in the Braveheart days. I could never have forgiven my family for this stain, this blight on the family. But apparently we wised up, sided with Robert the Bruce, and all we knew is that Clan Watson, or Sept Watson, was under Clan Buchanan, and they eventually helped the Scottish fight against the English, but it wasn't exactly a heritage to be proud of. And what I learned is that while we never reached clan status, we did apparently have our own motto, we Watsons. Now, it should be noted that mottos of clans and septs, they're inspiring. Consider Clan Buchanan's, brighter hence the honor. They're smart people, therefore they're honored. Clan MacGregor, my race is royal. Right? Clan MacNab, let fear be far from all. Clan Wallace, not surprisingly, for liberty. Clan MacDougall, conquer or die. Clan Mackenzie, I shine, not burn. Clan MacIntosh, touch not the cat without a glove, which is a little strange. That must have been one wicked cat. Oh, you'll get messed up if you touch it without a glove. But Sept Watson, our motto is Inspirata Floriat. Translation, flourishing unexpectedly. Flourishing unexpectedly. It really doesn't sound impressive. And I'm so curious. I don't know how these models came about. I'm curious. Was this like a council meeting where it's like, okay, we gotta have mottos. We gotta hand out mottos to every clan. I'm just imagining that council. Fergus, Duncan, we gotta give out mottos to the clans. Those MacDougalls, they're real warriors, always wanting to conquer. They'd rather conquer than die. That sounds good to me. MacIntosh, we know how they feel about cats and gloves. That's an easy one. The Watsons, though, I can't believe they're still here. They're a real unimpressive lot, I gotta tell you. But they're flourishing, unexpectedly. There we go. I mean, who gives us this motto? It's just embarrassing. And yet, I can't deny the truth of the words, because here I am, flourishing unexpectedly. These are my people, my tribe, my sept. I belong to a long line of Watsons who have flourished throughout history, not excelled, mind you, or fought courageously, just flourished unexpectedly. That's my heritage. Which brings me back this Advent season to Jesus' genealogy. In the rich mystery of incarnation, the mystery of the incarnation and the way of life that it calls us to. And again, when you look at Jesus' genealogy and heritage, it makes for some dull reading, but there's some really important clues found in Jesus' lineages. It speaks to his identity, the origin of Jesus, and what it means, I think, for us to walk the Jesus path. And one of the most striking things we learn from Jesus' genealogy is that Jesus belonged not just to a group of people called the Hebrews, but he belonged to a specific tribe within his people. We know, of course, the Hebrew people were divided into 12 tribes. After they left Egypt, they come into the Promised Land, 12 tribes. It originated with Jacob's 12 sons. And each of the tribes were given a specific piece of land that was theirs in Israel to call home. And Jesus traces his lineage back all the way to the tribe of Judah. Jacob and Leah, their fourth son was Judah. And like any tribe or sports team or club, a tribe gives you a particular identity. It gives you a history, a mythology, you could say. And so it was for the tribe of Judah. Now, to start, the tribe of Judah was the home of Israelites, their monarchy, beginning with, of course, David and Solomon, on it goes. They were the leaders and rulers of the nation of Israel. It was part of their tribal identity that they were leaders. And they also developed a tribal identity from the blessing that Jacob gave to his sons directly before he died. Now, these blessings are rather curious to me. You can read the whole thing in Genesis 49, but it makes some fascinating reading because Jacob's about to die, he's on his deathbed, and it's kind of, you know, a blessing at the end of their life. It's kind of like handing out your will, you know, giving everyone their inheritance, their blessing. So he gathers his 12 sons around him. So there's Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Joseph, and Benjamin. And this scene must have been the most awkward deathbed scene in history because he's about to hand out blessings to his sons, and some of them are weird. For instance, Reuben, son number one, the firstborn, his father says to him, no blessing for you because you've defiled my bed, a.k.a. apparently Reuben's sleeping with somebody, Jacob. I don't know what's going on there, but he defiled his father's bed. Simeon and Levi, brothers 2 and 3. Jacob says to them, you're too violent, too angry, no blessing for you. So they don't fare very well in their father's final words. Zebulun, brother 5, gets a few words about you're going to live by the sea and be a haven for ships. All right? Not great, but, you know, better than the other three. Jacob calls Issachar, brother 6, an ass. You're an ass. And you're bound to succumb to forced labor, like an ass would. Jeez, this is getting really awkward, family reunion here. And sticking with the animal analogies, Dan, brother 7, you're a viper. You're like a snake in the grass. Not good. Gad, brother 8, you're going to be attacked. Okay, thanks, Dad. Asher, brother 9, will have good food. So he's the cook of the family. And yet he's like, you're going to have to serve it to the king, so you're still kind of a servant. Good food, but you're going to have to serve it to the king. Naphtali, brother 10, back to the animal analogies we go, he's described as a doe with beautiful kids. So it's like the rest of you are kind of ugly. Okay, Naphtali, you get the good looks of the family. Joseph, brother 11, right? We all know about Joseph, the amazing technicolor dream coat. He was always Jacob's favorite, and he gets 19 lines of blessing. Just, we wonder in that story, right, like why his brothers hated him. Well, this is a good reason right here. You're daddy's favorite for sure. And if blessings are a finite resource, like he just took 90% of the pie. And then Benjamin, brother 12, again, we're back to animals. He's like, you're like a ravenous wolf. In this chapter of blessings, in some cases it sounds more like the chapter of curses. It ends with this note. All of these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them, giving each the blessing appropriate to him. Now, of course, I've skipped Judah's blessing, but these final words spoken to the 12 sons and founders of the tribes of Israel are, you know, they would become part of their tribal identity. It would shape who they would become. It would shape how they would act over the centuries. Because in the ancient days, words mattered, blessings mattered, curses mattered. And this would shape their tribal identity in the years ahead. Now, Joseph, we know, does really well in the blessing department. A few brothers do okay, and others get nothing but harsh words. But Judah, his blessing is curious. It's intriguing. Again, highlights Jacob's affinity for likening his son to animals, but
While some kids are compared to wolves or deers or snakes, Judah claims the animal prize lot when Jacob calls him a lion. This is the complete blessing. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his. Early in Genesis here, a peace to the nation is going to come through this tribe. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will mash his garments in wine, Eucharist, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. Ooh, it's a mysterious blessing. Flattering. Jacob, you and your descendants will be leaders, rulers, and one day, through your lineage, someone will come who will bring peace to the nations. You will defeat the enemies. You will produce a universal king. This king will draw together all nations, and somehow it's going to come about through vines and grapes and blood. It's a real shaper. An identity comes out of this. Belonging to this tribe was an identity shaper for Jesus. This was the tribe he was raised in. Jesus was not only Jewish of the Hebrew people, more specifically, he was from the lion tribe of Judah. Jesus was raised to think in terms of tribes. And I think if we're going to work to see the way God works in our lives and around us, if we're going to travel the Jesus path, this is where I think a way of life comes into being, we would do well to do the same. How so? Well, you are part of a tribe. In fact, you're probably part of many tribes. And I just want to throw in a little side note here. Especially recently, I understand and appreciate that some people of color in indigenous communities, they feel that using the word tribe, it contributes to the myth that being tribal equates to being primitive. And I just want to wholeheartedly reject that notion up front. I would never want to contribute to that myth. So when I use the word tribe in tribular, I'm simply trying to connect the Bible's idea of tribe with a universal sociological phenomenon. But you are part of a tribe, probably several. And this is the weird thing, you know, we in the West, we don't think about that. We don't think about tribes, at least in the traditional way of thinking about tribes. Those that I live closest to, even in this room, we probably come from a wide variety of ethnic backgrounds. And so thinking tribally, initially, we think of ethnicity, right? But that's been mostly lost on us. Many of us feel like we don't belong to a tribe. Sounds like a bit of a relic from a bygone age. And yet, while most of us don't think that way, the reality is that we are just as tribal as ever. How so? Well, 2008, Seth Godin released a little book. I love it. Tribes, We Need You to Lead Us, it was called. And the idea of the book is short and straightforward and to the point. The idea of the book is simply this. Humans always have and always will organize themselves into tribes. And if you understand that, you will understand the human psyche on a more profound level. We always have and always will think tribally. And Godin, of course, he wants to use this knowledge to help people sell things, right? But consider how he defines a tribe. A tribe is a group of people connected to one another, connected to a leader, and connected to an idea. For millions of years, human beings have been part of one tribe or another. A group needs only two things to be a tribe. Shared interest and a way to communicate. That's all you need. Shared interest, way to communicate. Now, we humans aren't short on interests, and the internet has given us unimaginable ways to communicate with one another. And realizing that, it means that probably most of us have several different tribal identities. There's a tribe today, you could say, for virtually every interest available. Consider this. I think I see John here today. Years ago, John was telling me he moved into a home. His home backed onto a park, and he had the greatest revelation to tell me. He said every Sunday afternoon in the park, He witnessed grown adults gather, dress up in costumes, and fight each other with Nerf weapons. And I was like, wait. Are you telling me, like, this isn't kids, this is adults? He's like, adults, grown individuals in costume fighting each other with Nerf swords and axes. And I was amused, but also wanted an invitation. What John was witnessing was the world of LARPing. Do we have any LARPers here? Don't be shy. It's okay. It's all right. Everyone's like, nah, I don't want to admit to that. Live action role playing. Oh, people are passionate about this interest. They've got their own conventions, their expos, trade shows. You develop a character. Oh, what fun. Or consider, I love reading books about little subcultures. And a while back, I read a book called Confederates in the Attic. It's about the U.S. South. And one of the things it exposed me to was there's a significant amount of people who spend a significant amount of time doing Civil War reenactments. I'm just trying to picture sitting around with a bunch of friends and be like, what do you want to do this weekend? I know. Let's get dressed up and do Civil War reenactment. Like, who are these strange people? But when I started digging into this, it cracked me up because they have levels. There's a whole hierarchy within Civil War reenactors. Categories of participation. They got names. There's FARBs. You don't want to be a FARB. FARB is a polyester soldier. They show up and they might be wearing Velcro. Please, that wasn't around in 1860. It's like the FARBs get made fun of, and then there's your mainstream reenactors, and then there's the highest, of course, there's the progressive reenactors. They sleep, eat, wear everything that was only available in 1860. Like, my goodness, what an odd little group of people. There's tribes everywhere. I was interested in, you know, increasing a sort of Zen mystique about myself for a little bit there. I wanted to get into bonsai trees. I thought that would be nice to throw into conversation. Well, my bonsai tree. Anyway, I thought it would be great. So I started looking into getting a bonsai tree, and it turns out in KW, there's a bonsai tree society, and they meet monthly. That ended my fascination. I didn't want another monthly meeting. But a bonsai tree tribe. I mean, how crazy can you get here? What about chopping wood? Yes, there's people who chop wood, but then there's a whole enthusiast group who chop wood the Norwegian way. And they've got a whole little society. They chop and stack. There's a tribe of people who go searching for rubber ducks on beaches. I'm not kidding. In 2006, a ship container fell off a boat in the ocean, and it had like a million rubber ducks in it. And they all started floating all over around the world, and now people just go searching for these rubber ducks. Like, what are you doing this weekend? Gotta find those rubber ducks. Like, what? Oh, my goodness. Humans are fascinating to me, because if you can think of an interest, chances are there's a tribe of people who are very passionate about it, and they communicate about it online together. Millions of tribal affiliations. We're all part of a tribe. Maybe you can start thinking of your own tribal affiliations. And of course, we know this comes with a slew of problems, right? There's a lot of hatred, abuse, violence that is often committed in the name of tribes. Consider sporting teams, soccer fans, political opponents, geographical tribal warfare. Even still, the reality is most of us belong to several tribes. There are people in this world that we consider our people. They get us. Our people. People in groups we feel at home and comfortable with. And as I mentioned the previous two Sundays, like the land we inhabit, what I believe the Jesus path is asking of us, first and foremost, is to remind us that God is at work in our tribes. Jesus belonged to a specific group of people, Jewish, from the tribe of Judah. He wasn't Greek, wasn't Roman. Canadian, American, but he did belong to a specific group of people, and it boggles my mind that Jesus' public ministry was relegated, confined to simply a small group of his people. There's one or two notable exceptions, but Jesus never ministered to anyone outside of the Hebrew people. He was focused on his people. And those who followed him would take the path message of Jesus all around the world, of course, but I believe the way of life that the Jesus path calls us to is this: find your people and minister to them. And I think to some of our minds, it's like this might seem insular and exclusionary. But when it came time to where Jesus spent his time and energy, he remained focused on his tribe of people. That's it. And that same path is available to us. And I believe it's the most liberating idea in the world. Because the reality is there's no shortage of people or groups in this world that are asking for our time and energy and money and advocacy. You just scroll through social media, news websites, it's enough to remind you of that. So many people need our help. The reality is, again, we're finite. That's what the incarnation, one of the messages, we're located in a particular time and place. We're finite. We cannot give ourselves to every worthy cause or need. We're human. So how do we decide what we give ourselves to, our lives to? The Jesus path, again, to me, offers a tactful reduction of options. Find your people, minister to them. And I can hear alarm bells going off in people's mind, like, oh boy, this sounds dangerous. Focusing on our people sounds like a comfortable way to ignore injustices and needs outside of our own interest. Hang with me one second, though. The way Jesus lived out belonging to a people is very telling, because his focus was almost entirely on the margins. Jesus belonged to a group of people and limited his focus almost entirely to the margins. As it was for Jesus, so it can be for those of us who travel the Jesus path. Find your people, then look to the margins. And I don't have time to unpack all the social mores of Jesus' day, but it doesn't take long reading through the Gospels to get that this was Jesus' focus. This is my people, and I'm going to look to the margins. Lepers. They were the sick and disgusting of Jesus' people. Don't go near them. What does Jesus do? Embrace. Heal. Bring them into the larger group. Tax collectors, you traitors, collecting for the Roman Empire that's oppressing us. What does Jesus do? Embrace on the margins, bring in. Women were considered second-class citizens. What do we see Jesus doing? Embrace on the margins, bring in. The demon-possessed, they would have been the crazies of the day. Crazies. Oh, geez, don't go near. Ugh. Let them hang out in their cemeteries, whatever. Jesus, embrace on the margins, bring into the larger group. He surrounds himself not with ivory tower, but the uneducated fishermen. Bring them into the group. Children, third-class citizens of the day, loves them, marginalized, brings them in. Sex workers, on the margins, brings them in. And of course, at the same time, Jesus dines with those in power, scholars, lawyers, wealthy, the religious elite. Jesus belonged to a specific group of people and then looked to the margins and sought to bring them into the larger group. Find your people, then look to the margins. Looking to the margins becomes manageable when we focus on our people as individuals and faith communities, because the tyranny of being a Christian sometimes is this. Every group of people you come across are like, wow, geez, I gotta love and be really nice to everyone. The power of saying no is amazing. When we first put our kids into hockey, there was a meeting of the parents, and our kids aren't in the room, are they? Our kids are really bad at hockey, like they're really bad, way behind everyone else. But put them into hockey, and there was a meeting with the parents, and it's like, all right, now we want to do some travel games, and we need to set up a fundraising community, and we need people to go around collecting bottles from recycle bins. I'm like, no, sorry, I'm out. I'm just not a hockey player. You are not my people. I'm sorry. I'm out. So now we have them in some league where Nobody cares how good they are. Nobody asked me to do anything. It's fantastic. I'm like, no, I'm sorry. You're not my people. I love you. I think it's great that you're doing all these committees for your hockey teams. I'm not doing it. You're not my people. Sorry. Or this week, oh my goodness, I love my neighborhood, but it gets a bit much sometimes in my neighborhood. Because every year on Christmas Eve, our neighborhood hosts Santa's Runway. One street in our neighborhood, they line it up with lanterns so Santa can figure out where to land. And it's really beautiful, actually, especially if it's snowing. But the way they hand this out is whatever street has the most people paint their front windows with some Christmas decoration scene. Whatever street has the most, you get to host Santa's Runway. And so every year, this year included, I get some well-meaning neighbor. Would you be willing to paint your front window for us? That way we can host Santa's Runway. I'm like, nope, you're not my people. I'm not a window painting person. That's not my tribe. Well, we've got a meeting that you can come to where you'll get all ideas about. No. No, I got one string of lights. That's it. Put it up. Maybe, but I'm not joining the window committee. Are you kidding me? I know myself. 3 years later, to be there chipping off. I wouldn't know what to do. No, you're not my people. And I can't tell you the unimaginable freedom of simply saying, nope. My focus in life is this, and I love you all, and I think it's great you paint your windows, and it looks beautiful, but you're not my tribe. And that sounds weird, doesn't it? You're like, oh, I don't know, you don't want to be mean to them. I'm not mean to the neighbors. I'm just, no, not doing it. Because the Jesus path for me is challenging, but it is navigable. Find your people, and then look to the margins. Who is it in your friend group? Every friend group, right? You know, there's always people kind of hanging on the margins. Who is it? In the tribes and subcultures, whatever it is you belong to, you're part of subcultures and tribes. You all are. Figure out who your people are and then go, you know what, who's hanging around the margins? Maybe I can bring them into the wider community. Be a friend. Maybe on your street, your workplace. Maybe you are that sports person, right? You're on all the committees, you're doing it. Great. You know your people. Now look to the margins. At work, you're like, I love the people I work with. Great. That's your people. Now who's the one who gets left out at lunch? Bring them in. A family. Now this one's tough, I know, right? But, you know, Christmas is coming, and maybe there's that one weird uncle that's always sitting alone on Christmas Day, and you're like, how you doing, Uncle Joe? I want to reach out to the margins. Maybe we consider our neighborhoods. Who's on the margins? Who's on the margins in this community? And can we be the person who makes that bridge? Hey, looks like you don't have someone to talk to. Maybe I can be that bridge. As groups, particular faith communities, the questions apply to us. Who are on the margins within our people? Who's on the margins in the larger community around us? To follow the Jesus path, and what makes it a beautiful, in my mind, way of life is it's simple. Find your people. Look to the margins. Of course, the next question is, well, what then? Ah, that's going to have to wait till January, huh? We've traveled far enough for now on the Jesus path. It's time to pause, catch our breath. Jesus' path begins with a disorienting climb, an exhausting climb, as we begin at Jesus' birth and incarnation. And what it says to us simply is this: develop a relationship with the land, find your people, look to the margins. The question becomes, can we stay awake to that reality? Next Sunday, we're going to talk specifically about Christmas and Advent, so I'll get right into that, make it more of a Christmassy morning, Advent morning type thing. And then December 24th, we are hosting a Christmas Eve service, 4 to 5 p.m. And listen, years ago, I made a mistake on Christmas Eve, and I tried to do something interesting, and nobody wants interesting on Christmas Eve, so let me just assure you, we're just going to sing Christmas carols, not the ones that nobody knows, the ones that everybody knows. We'll just do that, and we'll have you out well in time for supper, and it'll be a lovely way to start our time together over Christmas. So I hope you will join us for that. I'm going to invite Carla now to come and lead us in a Eucharist reflection. Thank you.